You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
Yeah, it's been a huge year for me, you know, winning E3 and such a great tour, getting married, honeymoon, book coming out and everything. But I think the highlight has to be winning the podcast Pedaleur des Champs award, for sure. That t-shirt, it's pride of place in my wardrobe.
This is only the beginning. You can't even imagine what we are going to do for the future.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
My name's Richard Moore, and in this week's cycling podcast, we are going to hear from two of the world's leading female riders, Lucy Garner and Lizzie Armitstead. Before we do that, though, let's hear from Lionel Burney with his weekly news roundup. Over to you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. I'm just off up to Derby Velodrome for a not-so-secret day of training on the track ahead of our Trainer Road race at the end of March. But before I go, I've just got time to update everyone on what's been going on in the world of professional cycling over the last week or so. First of all, the Tour of Oman. Vincenzo Nibali, the Italian champion, won the stage on Green Mountain to set up his first stage race overall victory since the 2014 Tour de France. It was a very strong week for the Norwegian riders. Alexander Kristoff took his fourth and fifth victories of the season when he won stages, and Edvald Boasenhagen, his compatriot, won a couple of stages as well. Down in the south of Portugal, Geraint Thomas won the Volta ao Algarve for the second year in a row. Big name winners left, right and centre this week, because Marcel Kittel took his fourth and fifth victories of the season, winning a couple of bunch sprints. Alberto Contador got his first victory of the season, and Fabian Cancellara won the time trial in Algarve. That was the 57th individual time trial win of his professional career. Over in southern Spain at the Ruta del Sol, Alejandro Valverde won that race for the fourth time. TJ Van Garderen won the time trial there, and there was a sprint victory for Nasser Bouhanni. And in the south of France at the Tour du Haut Var, a two-day stage race, Cannondale's Tom Jelte Slagsa won a stage and Arthur Vichot won the second stage to take the overall title. Away from the races, rumours are building that Prince Nasser bin Hamid Al Khalifa of the Bahrain royal family is planning a World Tour level team for the 2017 season, and that Vincenzo Nibali is top of his shopping list. And finally, we were saddened to hear that former Eurosport commentator David Duffield had passed away at the weekend, aged 84. For those who watched coverage of cycling on Eurosport in the 1990s or early 2000s, Duffield was the voice of cycling. Duffers, as he was affectionately known, had a unique and often amusing turn of phrase. During long stints in the commentary box, often without a co-commentator, he would sometimes go off at a tangent talking about the food or the wine, which could sometimes be exasperating for the hardcore bike racing fan. But Duffield never forgot that his audience was broad, and it was not solely made up exclusively of bike racing obsessives. What was never in doubt was his passion for the sport. Here's one of his most famous bits of commentary. It's from the 1992 Milan-San Remo.
The crowd at the finish have just been told that Kelly's caught Arnaut out. They can't see what you can see, and they've gone, oh. There's depression set in at the moment in the finishing arena, and they're all peering anxiously down to see. And look at the gap now. The telephoto lens is for shortening the gap. It's not as close as you would think, but it's still enough for that big punch. If the bunch really start to roll, they might catch these two in front, in the red and the yellow on the front. That's Bellino Argentin. In the blue behind him is Sean Kelly from Ireland. Kelly now begin to wind it up. Argentin in front of him. Swinging around the corner, the crowd now can see that they're... Man is on the front, the Italian versus the Irish, and he cuts across Kelly, but down got the crash behind. One of the Motorola boys has gone down with the bank. I think Thomas has gone as well. Kelly's gone away. Kelly's going to get it. Kelly gets it. Sean Kelly, the winner of the 83rd Milan-San Remo. What a way. 6 hours, 26 minutes and 23 seconds of racing, and Kelly is back with a bang, and this lot are down likewise with a bang. And yes, I thought it was Motorola that bit the dust. Bad luck for them, but good luck for the Irishman himself.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Thank you for that, Lionel. Now, as I said, we're hearing in this episode from Lizzie Armitstead and Lucy Garner Garner, of course, is the former double junior world champion, and Armitstead is the current world road race champion, having won a memorable race in Richmond, Virginia last September. Armitstead will make her 2016 debut at Het Nieuwsblad this weekend, and a week later, she will be one of the riders riding Strade Bianche, the first event in the inaugural UCI Women's World Tour Series. We're going to hear from Lucy, then from Lizzie, then Lucy again, then Lizzie again, and then Lucy again, and so on. You get the picture. But I went recently to southern Spain to catch up with the two of them separately. Lucy Garner in Calpe, where she was training, and Lizzie Armitstead just along the coast in Moreira, where she was training. And I started talking to Garner about Armitstead. 21-year-old Garner was part of the British team that helped Armitstead win her world title in Richmond. And so I asked her, what is the world champion like as a leader?
Yeah, even just when you're around her, you can feel the sort of how professional she is. She's so driven. She knows what she needs to do. I think she's quite a very independent person as well. Like, she does a lot of her training herself. I know that. And yeah, she just sets a goal and she can just seem to do it. Like, she'll go away, you don't see her racing for a while, and she'll come back and she'll be like five times as amazing as she was before. So yeah, she definitely has sort of a big role. And I think as well, like at the World Championships this last year, we were a young team, and she really made us all come together and just really believe that we could help her and do something for her, which was really nice.
How does she lead? I mean, is she somebody who sort of stands up and gives you a talk beforehand, or does she speak to you individually? Does she put her arm around you? Does she give you very detailed instructions? How does she operate?
Well, she knows what she wants, so we'll have the team meeting, and then she said the plan that she she wanted to do, and then she said, okay, maybe you can do this, maybe you can do that. And yeah, at the end of the day, she knows how she will perform, and she's the best in the world, so it's just us trying to do what we can for her. But yeah, she's very relaxed as well. I never saw her sort of get really stressed or anything. She's just very calm, collected, and yeah, cool.
So we heard there from Lucy Garner talking about Lizzie Armitstead. Let's hear now from Armitstead herself. Last year she had a difficult winter, she admitted, after the disappointment of missing out on a world title that seemed to be hers for the taking in Ponferrada. So I asked her, what has life been like this winter, having finally won the rainbow jersey?
Hard in different ways, I suppose. Yeah, last year I had a really hard time dealing with the disappointment, because I'd gone into that World Championships with incredible form, so physically I was capable of doing it. And if you go into a race and you get the tactics wrong, you can't really go away and work harder on it. Like, if it was a physical problem, then I'd go away, train harder, and I'd be better. But I got the tactics wrong, so it was a huge disappointment. And to be honest, I probably didn't switch off enough last off season. I worked really hard. I probably had about 2 weeks off the bike after the World Championships, not enough. This year has been very different. I had a lot longer off the bike, but I was a lot busier. So I don't know what's been better preparation, but it's been a hard winter again.
But last year you almost seemed to be soul searching. You know, you'd done everything, as you say, right. You were in great condition physically, and it hadn't gone right on the day. And one day racing is where your heart lies, isn't it, really? And so much can go wrong. Were you sort of doubting last winter whether all the sacrifice, all the work was actually worth it?
Yeah, definitely. But at the same time, that's why I love cycling. I love that aspect of it. That's why I chose road racing over track racing. There's that kind of mystery about it and the unknown about it. Anything can happen. And that's what I love about the sport. So I came to terms with the fact that I lost and just kept plugging away. I don't think world champions are lucky. You know, you do have to work hard for it and just keep plugging away and you'll get there, I suppose.
And has it been a sort of opposite feeling this winter, where it did all go right and you said how in control you felt on the day? You felt the race was yours for the taking. It all went, you were in great physical condition, it all went right tactically. Has that sort of made you more relaxed about your sport and more in control?
I think so, yeah. I think with age as well, you get this kind of perspective on it. And I suppose it's become more of my job now, and I'm able to switch off from it more. I suppose, yeah, self-belief's been hugely improved, because obviously I'm self-coached as well. It's sometimes difficult to know whether what I'm doing is right. but it was kind of a validation of everything that I've done, I suppose.
Being self-coached does make you quite unusual. Is there, and you've been, you know, part of the British system in the past, in terms of how that works, are you somebody who devises or designs a program that you follow, or is it very much done on sort of feel, on instinct?
No, it's I think people often get it wrong and they think, oh, she's self-coached, that means that she doesn't have structure, and that's not the case. I have complete structure, just like anyone who has a coach. I'm the coach part, so yeah, I plan out my training in advance and analyse it afterwards, just like a coach would.
How do you do that? I mean, how far in advance do you do that? And what's the sort of philosophy behind it? Do you read? Do you speak to people? Where do you get your knowledge, your information from?
Yeah, I'm really interested in physiology. I read a lot. I suppose I'm a bit like a sponge. I listen to people around me, soak up the information, take from it what I want. I phase plan at the start of the season, so I look at my race program. I discuss that quite closely with Danny Stam, my director, and then kind of fit in the training probably 2 weeks in advance. I'd plan it.
I suppose what a lot of people like about having a coach is that they can sort of pass a bit of responsibility to the coach, you know, and also it takes away the question every morning, what will I do today? You know, you've only got to explain a missed training session to yourself rather than to a coach. Does that make it harder in some senses?
I just really struggle giving away that responsibility. I think where I'm in a really unique position doing the job I do, that it's such a selfish thing, really, at the end of the day. It's totally about my victory. That's all, you know, that's everything I do. All the sacrifices I make are really quite selfish. It's all about me. So I didn't want to give that responsibility away to someone else. I think I know my body better than anyone else, and I trust myself to get myself in the best shape.
But sorry to go back to this, I'm thinking about, you know, how easy it is to talk yourself out of to rationalize maybe having an easier day, or, you know, if you'd planned a 4-hour ride and you're maybe wake up feeling not 100%, you can sort of talk yourself around into doing something else. Is that a constant conversation that goes on in your head, or are you quite good at just sticking to the plan that you've devised?
I suppose it used to be when I was younger and probably not as committed as I should have been. But now, no, it's the opposite problem. I probably do too much, and I miss having that coach sometimes to tell me to hold back and rest and not panic. And, you know, I suppose from a mental perspective, I do miss sometimes that reassurance of a coach, but I'm also a really bad communicator. I don't pick up my phone very often, so the idea of having to ring up somebody every day and discuss how my legs are feeling is just a bit tedious for me.
And you're somebody who trains on your own most of the time, aren't you? You live in Monaco. There's obviously a lot of cyclists who live there. Big groups go training there. But what's the reason for wanting to train on your own?
I just really see it as my job. So when I'm on the bike, I want to be making the best of it. So I want it to be quality all the time. I don't want junk miles. There's plenty of time for that after my career to kind of enjoy the bike again, but I've only got a short career and I want to make the most of it, so every time I'm on the bike I'm pushing the wind, basically.
What's Monaco like? You've been there a few years now. I suppose people will have an image of it as a very glamorous place, lots of glamorous people. I mentioned the group rides. There's a sense maybe some riders go there and don't do as well as they should because they fall into that habit of, you know, doing the easier group rides perhaps rather than the pushing the wind themselves. But how do you obviously manage that side of it very well, but life in general, what's it like in Monaco compared to Otley?
Yeah, Otley and Monaco are very different. Both have got their strong points. Monaco's strong point would be the weather and the food. You know, year-round sunshine has made a huge difference to my career, to be honest. Just that being able to ride every day in the mountains in the sun undoubtedly has had a positive impact. The people there in Monaco, yeah, of course, you know, it's the rich and the famous there, but I'm a very small fish in that pond, and it's quite nice because I found a genuine set of friends, all quite like-minded, all there for the same reason, sports people. So yeah, I really like it. I don't think I'll settle there long term, but as a cyclist, it's a good place to be.
I don't get the impression you'd be that easily impressed by some of the famous people there. Would that be a correct impression?
No, it's not really my scene, to be honest.
You're not doing selfies or collecting autographs?
Oh, I can't stand selfies. As soon as selfies die out, I'll be a happy woman.
So Lizzie Armitstead, not a huge fan of the craze for selfies. Let that be a warning to you. Let's hear now from Lucy Garner again, who changed teams over the winter, moving to Wiggle High Five. She has ridden for a Dutch team since turning pro. So why did you feel the time was right for a change?
I think it was just a time for me to change. I got to the point where I wasn't sort of progressing as much as I wanted. And yeah, the girls were great on the team. But I just thought, yeah, I really just want a different move. And I think, yeah, Wiggle were really interested in me, even though sort of at the start of the season I had a lot of problems with my knees and couldn't do a lot of the races. Wiggle were still really passionate and wanted me on the team. And yeah, it's a great team and it's like now ranked number one. So yeah, it's a good team to be on, definitely.
Well, I mean, is there going to be a different role for you there? Will there be an opportunity to lead the team races? They've obviously got some very strong riders, some winners on that team. But will you have a sort of different role there, do you think?
I think so, but I think it will really bring me on. I'm a sprinter, so I can learn a lot from the sprinters on the team. And yeah, I just think that if I can sort of race the final without actually sprinting, I can learn a lot from that. Because I've found being with Liv, I was doing a lot of the finals but not necessarily knowing what I was doing. So I think that I can learn a lot by sort of being the last lead out girl for Jolien or, yeah, Bronzini, and just, yeah, really trying to develop my engine and then work on the sprint at the final. Yeah.
I mean, you're still only 21. You came into the senior ranks as a double junior world champion. It's always difficult to take that step up, but it must be especially difficult when you come in with that sort of reputation and when you're used to winning at the highest level. How difficult was it, not even so much physically, but mentally, to go from winning races to learning all over again?
It was the hardest thing that I think that I've had to face actually in my life. It was really, really tough. And obviously as well, like, I'd move countries and moved complete, like, the whole surrounding and everything sort of was completely different. So yeah, the first year it was really hard, like, mentally. And like, I went to my first race and as soon as we got to the first like little hill, I was just spat out the back. And then you think to yourself, okay, yeah, this is completely different playing field that you're in. And yeah, for me it took, I think, over a year to really like get that click. And I think for me it was just really, really important to set my own goals, because obviously as a junior I was just going there to win. But now it's like, okay, you've got to make sure you can survive until the second climb, just goals like that. And then you start to see the results and you can sort of, yeah, reward yourself rather than feeling disappointed all the time.
So when you turned senior and you were told that in 3 years this is where you'll be, this is the point you'll be at, are you happy that you're progressing at the rate that you thought you would progress at, the year that you wanted to progress at?
In some ways yes and in some ways no. I think in terms of the bike, I feel like I probably could have got a bit more out of myself last year. Of course, I can't always blame the knee problems, but I just think, yeah, I just need a bigger engine. So that's what I'm really trying to work on this year. And I think, yeah, being with Wiggle, there's a lot of experienced riders. And even on the training camps that we were doing, like, it was a good pace that we were riding at. I can feel like I know that I can improve in the team. So, yeah, that's what I need, really, the engine. And then, yeah, because the sprint, I always think it's like something that you can't really lose. If you're a sprinter, then it's, yeah, you've always got it and you can try and improve on it. So
this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So we heard there from Lucy Garner on her early years as a pro. She's a rider of great promise, of course, a few years behind Lizzie Armitstead, who we're about to hear from again. Here she is talking about the responsibility of being world champion, wearing the rainbow jersey, and the attention that comes with it.
It's a bit of a weird one, really, because the reason I started cycling was because of my love of cycling and my love of winning. And then you kind of have this almost like a responsibility in my position, especially with women's cycling, with the way it's, you know, trying to get exposure. You kind of have to take responsibility for that and engage in that media stuff. And to be honest, it doesn't come that naturally to me. It's not something that I crave. I don't crave the attention, but I suppose, yeah, it's part of the job.
Can you get away with maybe putting on a black jersey one day and not bothering with the rainbow jersey? You have to wear it every day, but are you ever tempted just to wear something a bit more anonymous?
Yeah, definitely. I was really, really sick over Christmas. I had a chest infection, and the first couple of days back, I just didn't feel like I deserved to be riding in it, to be honest. I was that slow. I just wanted to be anonymous. I didn't want people hanging on my back wheel and feeling like I had to ride faster.
You can tell us whether you did that or not, or maybe not. You don't want to get in trouble. You haven't raced yet this year, obviously, but the season is almost upon us. You will have that jersey. It's like a target almost on your back. What do you think that will feel like?
Good. I mean, I race well under pressure. I always need pressure to do well, so that's a good thing. I understand where this curse of yellow jersey, that's wrong. The curse of the rainbow jersey has come from. And it's not about some ridiculous curse. It's just the fact that you do have this pressure and you have a busy winter and all those things add up. So I'm hoping that I've managed that well and I'll just approach the races like I did last year, the same way.
Both Lizzie and Lucy have left behind the British system to forge their own paths in women's road racing on the continent. Armitstead currently rides for the Dutch team Bulls Dolmans. But this was a path to the continent that Lucy seemed determined to follow from a young age. I asked her how she got into the sport in the first place.
Well, my dad was really passionate about riding his bike, and so was my uncle, and they did a lot of just, local cyclocross races and things like that. And I always went to watch, and I tried so many different sports, but I thought, cycling was pretty different. No one really did it, and that's something what made me want to do it again. But I just really like being out on my bike, and you can just go wherever you want kind of thing. And my dad used to take me on really nice trails and all things like that, and I just like being out in the open rather than sort of stuck inside.
Were there any, I mean, as you got into fun sport, were there any female riders that you looked up to, or male riders that you looked up to?
When I first started, I was quite I was quite big on the track, so I did a lot of that. So I looked up to Victoria Pendleton a lot. I thought she was really glamorous and was cycling really well. So I really liked that. When I started being under 16, it was sort of Marianne Vos, because she was doing every discipline that I was doing. And everyone looks at like she's such a good role model for young women, young girls. So
I mean, being a sprinter, you're obviously a road rider, but you've got the sprint. Was the track something that interested you, maybe not as a sprinter but as an endurance rider on the track? Was that something that you were tempted by?
It was at the start. I did a lot of lot on the track, and obviously I did a lot of the Hales Owen leagues and things like that. And then I was part of the talent team, and you just move going from talent team to then ODP. They are quite track based, so you are made to do quite a lot of track. So then I was doing a lot of training, and I had quite a successful junior sort of at the Europeans and things like that. But I just found that I loved the road a lot more. I loved just being able to go out and just ride wherever than riding in circles.
And you did it. You did it the old school way of going to the continent and basing yourself there. What was that like, making that move across? And again, why that there is an opportunity for British riders now to be very well looked after as part of the British system. Why were you tempted to take a different path?
It was actually my dream. I always wanted to sort of move to Holland, actually, and be a professional racer. So, it was a risk, but it was something that I was willing to take. And, I was lucky enough to have a successful junior career. And then, obviously, Argos came along, and it was a really big team. And I thought, I can't miss this opportunity just to get stuck in with the women's peloton and just see. And if it didn't work, it didn't work. But I just didn't want to give up that quick.
And you were saying earlier that you feel almost more Dutch, or you feel more at home in Holland than you do in the UK now.
Yeah, definitely. It's really nice to be there. And obviously, it's coming up to 3.5 years now that I've been there. So I'm learning the language.
Well, I was going to say, how's your Dutch?
I can understand.
Give us a blast of Dutch.
No, now I don't know what to say. Now I can't do it like that, but. No, like, if we're on the start line, then they can't talk about me now they do it, so I can understand what they're saying. But no, I'm still a little bit shy speaking it. But no, it's really nice, and obviously I've got Lars there and his family, and I've got my own friends, and it is, yeah, a whole new life there now.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. For £10, you'll have access to our Friends Specials, 11 in-depth episodes that will take you even further inside the sport. All our Friends Specials are now available on your mobile device. Our 2015 Friends Specials are also still available for £5. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.
Lizzie, can I take you right the way back to when you started cycling? You were famously sort of talent spotted as a young kid. I don't know if I've ever actually heard the story from you about what exactly happened that day.
Yeah, so the Olympics were announced in London, and a British cycling initiative happened where they went into schools looking for kids who had potential on a bike. So luckily enough, they came to my school, basically a van full of bikes, a couple of cones around the school field and a race, and I did it to get out of a lesson. And yeah, from there I went onto a programme. I was given a coach and a bike.
Did you ride a bike much prior to that?
No, I mean, I rode a bike playing out as a kid, but I didn't own a bike from about the age of 10 to 15. It's not what teenage girls spent the money on, you know. So it didn't really grab my imagination. The 500 quid lottery funding is what got me into it, to be honest. But, you know, that was more than I was earning waitressing, so that's what I did.
And what was it? I mean, was it talent? Was it obvious? Was it something that you felt you had something that you were good at? I mean, in that initial race, was it something that you felt, oh, I can do this?
I mean, I was a good runner and I was a good all-round athlete. I was kind of in all the school teams, but I was never the best at anything. And I really feel that cycling was the first sport that I was the best at, yeah.
So when did the bug bite? Was it a case of your appreciation, enjoyment of the sport growing as you realised you were better at it, or was there a moment where you started to quite like the sport? Did you watch the racing?
I went to watch a track World Cup in Manchester, and I saw Chris Hoy and Vicky Pendleton, and the crowds and sort of the glamour and the excitement, and started to learn more about cycling, I suppose, and the history and the tradition involved, and I fell in love with it that way, yeah. And then I saw that I could make a career out of it, and that's when I started to take it more seriously.
And what sort of age and what stage were you at then? Were you still at school when you sort of started having designs on becoming a professional?
Yeah, I was junior. So I was on the junior British track programme, and there was this under 23 programme that you could get on if you got results, and that was kind of my aim. Instead of university, I wanted to move to Manchester to the track.
And when did road racing get under your skin?
Very quickly, actually. I mean, I liked the sort of straightforwardness of the track, that if you put in the work, then generally you came out with a medal if you're part of that British cycling setup. But then I loved the unpredictability and the travel and the sort of a new team every year, new teammates, all those different things that you get on the road, and I just loved road racing.
And you know, you mentioned that, you know, you coach yourself, you're very much your own person. What was it like being part of that British setup? That you know, that system was very well established by the time Chris Hoy, Vicky Pendleton were performing as they were, and you know, through Beijing and so on, there was a real machine there. Mm-hmm. How did you find life within that machine?
I didn't like it very much, yeah. I liked it when I was a points race rider, and the points race was in the Olympics, and that was the aim, because you could combine it with the road and the track. But then it turned to the Omnium and the team pursuit, and you became really part of it. You had to become part of a team in so many ways that you had to train as a unit every day and do very similar training to each other. And I just didn't like that aspect of it. I felt like I wasn't fulfilling my training needs as an individual. And it's very sort of same routine, same track every day, same circles every day, and I just struggle with that. It wasn't the beauty of cycling, that kind of romantic view of being out and chasing your dreams in the beautiful scenery. That's what I missed.
So you're quite, you know, you're quite pragmatic in some ways, but also quite romantic in your attitude towards your cycling. Would you say a combination of the two?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, a definite combination. Like, I still would prefer to go out and not use a Garmin and a power meter. I would prefer to go out and just ride my bike and suffer and then have a look up and see where I've got to. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, quite a few guys have come out of the British setup. Dan Martin, the Yates brothers, people like that, and done pretty well because there's a pathway for men. It's harder for women, isn't it, to step out of that machine, because all the support that's there for you as a woman is harder to find, perhaps, in the outside of the British cycling system.
I suppose so, but as a British woman, if your dream lies on the road, then actually it's probably easier than being a British man, because if you're a British man on the road, then you would probably, the easiest path would be to get onto Team Sky and do it that way, and there isn't that for a British woman, so you do have to go out into Europe and find your team that way. But I don't think it's necessarily harder, it's just different.
Nevertheless, I guess it was a risk to do your own thing.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, when I decided to focus on the road, it was going into Olympic year. If I'd have stayed on the track, then hopefully I would have been in that team pursuit team and come away with a medal, and a medal was definitely not sure at that point on the road. But I was in a position where I could choose a career that I loved or stay in something that I didn't love. And I'd seen a lot of Olympic medalists actually who'd won gold medals and weren't that happy along the way, and I prefer to enjoy the journey to an Olympic medal.
So, you know, you did come away with a silver medal in London. Had you stuck the track, you might have had a gold medal. But I guess you don't look back on that with any sort of regret, do you?
No, definitely not. I mean, the girls in that team pursuit team deserved that gold, and all credit to them, because it's, like I say, it's not just about putting in the time on the bike. It's so much more when you're up in Manchester. It's high pressure, and I don't know if I could have done that, to be honest. I needed my own path and I needed to do the road, so no way. I'm very proud of that silver.
Do you ever look back on that, on the road race? Marianne Vos was such an outstanding favourite, and I didn't realise you're actually very close in age to Vos. She just seems to have been around forever. I'll speak about her in a moment, but you know, that was an outstanding ride. It was the second day of the Olympic Games. You got all the headlines, Queen Elizabeth on the Times, I remember, the wraparound on the Times. But do you ever look back on that sprint and think, maybe the gold medal could have been mine?
No. I mean, there was one point that I could have done differently. My instinct, actually, was about 2 seconds before she made her jump. I had an instinct to duck up the inside and go for it, but I think she still would have beaten me. I could have given myself a better chance, but she was faster than me.
Maybe it's a stupid question, but also, would it have been almost too much too soon? Given all the, you know, you got a hell of a lot of attention for this, for the silver medal, a gold would have, you know, I'd be talking to Dame Elizabeth Armitstead now, probably. would it almost have been, I'm sure you don't, you know, you would never regret winning a gold medal, but might it have just been too much too soon?
Yeah, maybe, possibly. I mean, I like the journey that I've been on. I've got a lot of silver medals in my career. I've, you know, Commonwealth Games was a silver until I turned it into gold, and there is something about that. There is a silver lining to a silver medal. You still have that motivation. And yeah, London was huge as a British athlete, and it definitely took its toll. The following year, I was absolutely shattered because I'd just not experienced that kind of thing before. So it was a valuable experience having before becoming world champion.
I was in the press conference there, and you know, you did make a few points about women's racing, the status of women's racing. I think Pat McQuaid had been there at the start, and you know, they were all very valid points delivered in your very understated way, but because of the Olympic Games and the effect that has on amplifying everything that's said, it was a big story for a few days, particularly, you know, before all the gold medals started coming. How was that experience for you? Was that something that you didn't particularly enjoy?
Definitely, yeah. I wasn't prepared for it at all. I was not media trained, I was young, I didn't expect any of that stuff. So I remember actually being in a taxi and calling my mum at home and being in tears because I'd read something on a newspaper and it had totally been taken out of context what I'd said, and I just wasn't used to it. I didn't know how to handle it, but I stand by what I said, and I'm happy I said it because I do think it brought a couple of things out in the open. And yeah, I suppose that's who I am. I'm not very good at sugarcoating things, and yeah, it's easier to be bland actually and to be boring in the media because it's less stressful and you don't get misquoted as much. But again, in my position as world champion, I think it's important that I do speak out about stuff if I think that it can help.
So it's clear that Lizzie Armitstead doesn't really like being the centre of attention, though she accepts the responsibility that comes with being world champion. So how does she deal with media attention? Has she developed strategies?
Yeah, I don't read stuff anymore. I don't read over an interview if I've done it afterwards, or I probably won't listen to this afterwards, just because, you know, you can get to...
It's a distraction, I guess.
Yeah, it's a distraction, and once it's been written, you can't change it anyway. And the way social media is and things like that these days, you just don't get drawn into it because there's always going to be critics, and it's easier to criticise than it is to say something positive. So, you know, the people that know me know what I'm really like, and it doesn't bother me too much if I get misquoted anymore.
Also, I guess you'll know, you know, if you're on that platform in Rio, you'll know the sort of Olympic effect, that amplification that I mentioned, and be aware of it. But as you say, you wouldn't presumably want to come across as a bland and, you know, very much on-message athlete, would you?
No, definitely not. I think it's important to have personality and be yourself. But I totally understand why people do become like that, because it is easier sometimes. It's a fine line, especially when you're talking about subjects like feminism, because... it's a very difficult sort of subject to talk about positively, and that's I do think I'm quite a positive person, and I wouldn't like to sort of moan or anything like that. I'm positive and I'm a realist, you know. I think there are huge steps that still need to be taken in women's cycling, and I understand the reasons why there's not that huge investment, you know.
Nevertheless, even since 2012, and you when you made those comments, I'm not suggesting a link here, but there have been great developments in women's cycling, and more planned in 2016 with the Women's World Tour. You know, to speak positively, are you encouraged by what's happened? Can you see a real sea change there?
Oh yeah, every year gets better, definitely. And I can't see it stopping. There's real momentum at the moment in the women's side of the sport, and yeah, the Women's World Tour should be good. Probably reserve judgment on it until we've had a year of it, because you just don't know whether the promises made will happen. So hopefully, fingers crossed, it'll have an impact.
And in the racing, you know, I mentioned Marianne Vos. She was for many years so dominant. You know, you couldn't help but admire her as an athlete, but races could be quite predictable as well. There seems to have been a real levelling off there in terms of the quality. There are quite a few riders now who can win races on different types of terrain. Is that because Vos has lost a bit of her edge, or is it because the others have caught up?
I think it's a combination. I think the fact that women's cycling is becoming more professional allows more female athletes to train properly, to be full-time athletes, is you know, has a huge impact. Yeah, Vos has obviously suffered with illness and injury the last 2 years, so it's difficult to tell really. But I think there's, like you say, the talent is spread a lot more now. The talent and the people that can win is a lot deeper. So I'm excited for her to come back into racing and see what happens.
Is she still the one that you would fear the most, or do you not fear your rivals?
Good question. Do I fear my rivals? I try not to. But I think about them when I'm training. You know, I think, has Vos got up today and trained as hard as I have? Has Anna van der Breggen trained as hard as I have today? At the moment, Vos doesn't come into my mind as much as she used to, no, because she's just not been there, so it's difficult. I would never underestimate Marianne Vos, never. She's an incredible athlete, and more so incredibly...
versatile?
No, strong-willed, you know, strong-willed. She's, you know, her will to win is incredible, so it'll be interesting to see what she does when she comes back.
You're talking about control a lot, and you know, in the context of the race in Richmond, you said you felt in control. I think a lot of people watching it wouldn't have shared your confidence. You know, it seemed to be quite a chaotic race in a way. But you seem to be concerned, in particular with a couple of riders, Bronzini and Dürr, and you know, you were, as long as they were eliminated, you felt more confident. But as breaks were going away, and as you seemed to make your effort towards the finish quite early, is that just with hindsight that you look back and go, I was in control? I mean, can you honestly say that during the race itself you felt that?
I can honestly say that is exactly what I planned to happen. Yeah. So in the training previous to the World Championships, I'd done the last climb, it's called Governor's Street. My plan was to attack on Governor's Street and then sprint again. I'd done it in Plouay very similarly, and it had worked. And I wanted to do exactly the same thing in Richmond. So in training the week before the World Road Race Championships, I did sprint up Governor's Street and sprint over the finish line, just without the crowds there. So I literally replicated that in the race.
And yet, when you crossed the line, you looked surprised. You know, the hand up to the mouth, you looked shocked. Was that... So it wasn't surprise that we were seeing there. What were we seeing?
Just like, wow, I've done it, I think. That was the emotion. It was like a cliff edge, just such a bizarre feeling. Because I'd focused on it so much, you know, missing out in Ponferrada, it was all I'd been thinking about. So I didn't want to believe it until I'd actually crossed the line, you know. I'd not tempted fate by thinking about it, not thought about a celebration or any of that stuff. So, yeah, I didn't get my hands in the air, unfortunately.
This is straight out of Steve Peters' book of, you know, how not to think beyond the actual finish line, not to think about the outcome, but think about the process. Is he somebody that you've ever spoken to?
Oh, I've sat in seminars, yeah. But sports psychology is not something I've ever really used. I suppose the thing that I took from his seminars was logic over emotion, and that's what I try to apply as much as possible. But a lot of it's, yeah, common sense and perspective on the fact that it's just a bike race, so, you know.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Lucy Garner, still a developing talent who will be riding in support in some races this year, I imagine, for Giorgia Bronzini and Yolene Dürr, her teammates. But I asked her about her own goals for 2016.
Personally, the Tour of Britain. The Aviva Tour, that's a real big goal of mine. I think last year I really enjoyed a lot of the courses and I had a nice result, but I wasn't on the form that I wanted to be, so I hope that I can perform well. Also, the National Championships. I've heard that it's not very, very hilly, so that would be a big target. And of course the Worlds as well in Qatar, that's something I think that can sort of benefit me as well, obviously Rio being next year, so I'd really hope to aim for that.
We talk a lot about, you know, how we can improve our coverage of women's racing. What are the things that, you know, imagine you were UCI president, what would be the three things that you would say would really help the sport and lift it up more?
Obviously, just the main one, like the publicity around it. I think that's the really important thing, just showing different races. Okay, it doesn't have to be all the races, but I think at the moment, or like in the past years, it's just the World Championships, and that's just one race in the year, and it's completely different to how we race the whole year. And it doesn't sort of represent what we are as sort of a group of cyclists. So I think that's something that, yeah, it has to push. And of course it's nice to have the sort of big races, like racing on the Champs-Élysées. I think it does really help, and obviously we get the crowds from the men's there, and then they can really see what we can do and how we can race. And I think just things like that, it really pushes it, and you get more of a bigger fan base, and then obviously people get more involved and have more interest and then know a bit more about the racing and everything. So
I read somewhere that you would love there to be a women's Paris-Roubaix.
Yeah, I think it would. Yeah, it's really cool. Like, I'm not sort of known as a rider to like that sort of racing, but like, I remember doing Flanders my first year and I loved that. It was like, yeah, I finished last, but it was just, you're just on these roads that are so well known, and it's just really nice to be there racing.
So that's Lucy Garner's dream, a women's Pyrou Bay. Let's now hear for a final time from Lizzie Armitstead. I asked her whether she trains with her fiancé, Team Sky rider Philip Degnan, but started by asking about her big aim for the year, the Olympic road race in Rio, which is on a tough, hilly course. She's been out to Brazil to recce it. So I asked her if the course is as tough as everyone is saying.
Brutal. There's nothing nice or easy about it. The person who wins the Olympic road race will be the strongest. There's no tactics involved. It's literally just going to be, for me, hanging on as long as possible and descending as fast as possible and getting into Rio.
It'll be a completely different sort of scenario to Richmond then, where you were trying to eliminate Bronzini, Dürr. There'll be people in Rio trying to eliminate you, yeah. I guess. So it'll change the way that you approach the race. Who are those people?
The American team are very strong. Well, obviously they're not being selected, but I would suspect they would select people like Megan and Evie, my teammates, and then Mara Abbott. She's won the Giro. She's an out-and-out climber. Then the Dutch, the French. So, yeah, they will be trying to drop me, like you say, on the climb. But I suppose it's nice for me just knowing that all I have to do is hang on, because I am the fastest of those people that can climb. So I've just got to hang on and limit my losses as best as I can.
And what, presumably it puts more of an emphasis for you this year on improving your climbing. What are you doing to that end when you're devising your training programs? Is it just more climbing? Is it losing weight? What's the plan?
Well, I suppose the simplest sort of example of what I'm doing is there's a hilly way home and there's a flat way home when I'm training, and I haven't taken the flat road home in 2016 yet. So I'm just trying to stick as much climbing as I can in. It's as much mentally, really, getting used to climbing and not fearing climbs, you know, spending as much time as I can in the mountains, really.
Your fiancé is a good climber. Do you ever train with him? Do you ever ride with him at all?
No, it's better for us not to. I mean, we have done the odd time, and I'll meet him for a coffee on a ride. But yeah, he is just a pure climber, and he just doesn't understand that for a sprinter-ish rider like me, then the climbs are really difficult, and he just can't get his head around it.
Well, beyond the physical thing, I mean, what, you know, presumably there's a mental aspect to it too. Can a pure climber give you any tips, advice?
Yeah, he's been really good actually with the training that I've been doing, because I suppose I've gotten so used to being so focused on punchy power that I try and do a 30-minute climb at the power that I can do a 10-minute climb, and he, you know, advises me I need to take that top end power off a little bit and get used to just riding in that sort of zone under the red line, really.
Yeah, I guess the consistency of the effort, I'm, you know, thinking even Cavendish in Copenhagen, it wasn't exactly a hilly course, but there was a climb on it, and the way that you manage your effort, you know, and especially in a circuit race, you know, every little effort you make counts, doesn't it? And if you can find, are you going to get out to Rio again before the Olympics or?
No, so I've got my power files and I've got videos from Rio, and to be honest, it's pretty scorched into my brain. I've not forgotten it. So
what are you more motivated by? Is it winning or not losing? Which provokes a stronger emotion?
Probably not losing, but I don't know if Steve Peters would think that's a good thing or not. I don't
never
know.
Never mind Steve Peters.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not losing. Yeah, I hate the thought of losing.
Have you been able to, given that, have you been able to enjoy, you know, looking back at the world title and basking in that a little bit?
Yeah, but funnily enough, I'd like to win another one, and then I'd know that I need to enjoy it more, because you're just thrown into this madness after a world title. You just become so busy, and I really miss riding my bike. It was so nice when I started riding again, just to have that quiet time on my bike away from all that kind of the circus that goes on about wearing a rainbow jersey. So I think I would like to win it a second time in order to be able to pick and choose a little bit more what I did and enjoy it a bit more.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
You heard there our long Trainer Road jingle, and earlier in this show, that of Eurosport. Thanks very much to both Trainer Road and Eurosport for their continued sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast. A quick plug before we finish for our new Friends special, which was released last week. It's a look back at the rise and demise of the Team of the Century. The full story on what happened to HTC High Road, a team that dominated the sprint finishes at least from 2008 to 2011. There are exclusive interviews with Bob Stapleton, Brian Holm, Mark Cavendish and Rolf Aldag, as well as Daniel Freeb, Lionel Burney and me reflecting on what made the team so successful and picking over the bones of their untimely demise at the end of the 2011 season. It's 90 minutes long and for anyone who's followed the sport in the last decade, a must listen. It's £10 to sign up as a friend of the podcast for 2016 and that will get you access to 11 Friends specials fully downloadable on your mobile device. This HCC High Road special is number 2 with one on Chris Froome released in January. Finally, a big thank you this week to Lizzie Armistead and Lucy Garner for giving so freely of their time. A lot of you have asked for more coverage of women's racing this year and it is something we are keen to do. Watch this space. I'll be back next week with Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb. In the meantime, thank you for listening.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.